Welcome to the Against the Stream Nashville podcast. In keeping with the Buddha's encouragement to ensure that these teachings are freely offered to all, we do not have any set dues or fees associated with any of our classes or media. In an effort to sustain our ability to do so, we ask that you contribute via our website at againstthestreamnashville.com by clicking the Donate tab, or via the mobile app Venmo by sending a donation to the username at ATS Nashville. Enjoy. Tonight I'm going to continue a series of talks I've been giving on what we call the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. The Four Foundations of Mindfulness are, they come from a discourse that the Buddha gave called the Satipatthana Sutta, which is a 2,600-year-old set of teachings that the Buddha gave on how to practice mindfulness. So really all of the instructions that we have today come from this very ancient discourse, which is kind of cool. And the way that I've been approaching these talks is I've been starting at the beginning. I started with mindfulness of the body, and I gave a couple talks on the body and breath awareness. And tonight I'm going to talk about mindfulness of feeling tone, which is the second foundation of mindfulness. But I'm going to look particularly at how to work with painful feelings. How do we work with pain? Emotional pain, physical pain. So very relevant topic. Hopefully you find that this is something that you could use. I like to look at the Buddhist teachings as a very pragmatic or a very practical, really it's a system, it's a psychological practice. Mindfulness is all about looking at our human experience, looking at how we relate to our body, how we relate to feeling, how we relate to mental states and attitudes and moods, watching our thoughts and the trouble that we get into up here in the mind. I often say that you can't shut the mind off, right? We can't turn it off, so we've got to learn how to be aware of it and babysit the mind a little bit. And so mindfulness is just a way of looking into these fields of human experience to try to see things how they are more immediately. We call this introspective awareness, being able to look into your own experience and to say, this is what's happening right now. We often are very externally aware. So we say, well, this is why I'm feeling the way I am right now. Or this is why I'm thinking the way that I am right now. It's because of this thing outside of me. But mindfulness is looking internally and externally in both, really. And so the Buddha called mindfulness the direct path to liberation. He says, monks, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of stress and discontent, for the acquiring of the true method, for the realization of awakening, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. That sounds pretty cool to me. Mindfulness is, in our day and age, in the Western world, mostly used and finds us through the lens of stress reduction, right? Helping us to really have impulse control, to find a moment of pause between action and reaction, to find a moment of being able to feel our experience rather than get lost in discursive thinking around our experience. Mindfulness as stress reduction, if you're looking at it from that lens, is giving us the ability to have more spaciousness, inner space, and more clarity. And while I think the Buddha would be, my opinion, encouraging mindfulness for the benefit of reducing stress, I think that ultimately what the Buddha was teaching is complete liberation from our stress. He says, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of stress and discontent. And so when I first heard about awakening or enlightenment, I thought of these ideas as something that, you know, were very intangible, very abstract. It sounded almost heavenly, out of this world. You know, but really, when the Buddha talks about disappearance of stress, what he's talking about is that we can develop such a clarity of mind that we can see not only how to meet what's stressful, but we can see how we perpetuate what's stressful, how we engage in our confusion, in our worry, in our suffering, and we can learn to develop insight. We can look inside our own mind to see its patterns, how it proliferates into stories that we identify with. So insight is the capacity to gain an accurate and deep intuitive understanding of a person, place, thing, or experience. So what mindfulness helps us do is to gain an accurate and deep intuitive understanding of suffering, of what causes stress, not just how to cope with distress, distressing emotions, anxiety, fear, but really what perpetuates those things from happening in the first place. And so if you look at the lens of psychotherapy, they're really interested in the same thing. Right? Carl Jung says we don't awaken by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. If you want to stop suffering, you've got to look at what causes it. And so mindfulness is much more than just how do we pause, be less impulsive, relax, allow ourselves to feel the experience. That's part of it. But it's also what is causing and creating and perpetuating suffering in our lives. And so what we're encouraged to do is we're encouraged to take a deep look into our body, into our mind, into our direct experience. And the Buddha's encouragement, and this is what I loved so much about his teaching, was to come and see for yourself. If you pour through the Buddha's discourses time and time and time again, it's almost as if he was trying to remind us of something that we have a habit to do, which is to cling to a guru or to a doctrine or to this idea of believing what the Buddha was saying. But the Buddha was a psychologist. He was saying, sit down, and if you want to understand suffering in your mind, you have to sit down and watch it. You just got to sit down and you've got to see, what is it like in here? And he gave us some things to look for. He gave us some supports. You know, and these are the four foundations of mindfulness. And so tonight I'm going to give, which is somewhat of a typical talk for my personality type. I am a overthinker by nature. And I'm going to give a bit of a technical talk on working with feeling and working with pain. And it's an important talk to give, although I'm apprehensive sometimes to give a technical talk, because when I hear someone talking about meditation technique, I start to tune out. And I'm like, I can't do that. I don't know what the hell they're talking about, right? Or maybe we haven't practiced much mindfulness, and so we feel like we're kind of left in the woods. But what's important is that as we practice mindfulness, we develop a way of seeing our experience and a way of working with our experience that we can start to talk about and we can start to share and we can start to find freedom and share the ways that we do that. So I'm going to share four strategies for working with pain using mindfulness. One thing that's important to say is that when I say mindfulness or when we talk about meditation, meditation from Buddha's language and perspective is not, meditation is not actually a word he used. That's a, I think, 12th century Christian word, meditation. But he used the word bhavana, which means cultivation. And so mindfulness is something that we're cultivating and we're developing throughout our daily activities. That meditation's not just when you sit quietly with your eyes closed, right? And so when we talk about bringing mindfulness into daily living or working with pain, we're really talking about how do we do this as we move throughout our day. So the first thing that I want to share about is how to work with painful feelings in formal meditation practice. And I'm going to share kind of these four ways, and we'll talk about and maybe do some of the practices. We'll see how much time we have. Feeling, in the Buddhist language, is a little bit of a confusing translation, because in the English language, I think we have like 14 definitions for the word feeling, right? We talk about feeling in so many different ways. Oftentimes, feelings are emotions, right? But you could also be feeling sick, which isn't an emotion. You could be like, you want to go eat later? I don't really feel like it, right? We have feeling for so many varieties of expression. In the Buddha's teaching, feeling is very, very simple. They call it a feeling tone. A feeling tone is just if this experience that we're in this present moment, feels pleasant, if it feels unpleasant, or if it's neither, neutral. So it's the primary likes or dislikes that we have in each moment of experience. And so when we work with painful feeling, our brain's natural reaction is conditioned to not want that. And it's the role really of our limbic system is we get emotional and we get activated and we resist when we come up against discomfort. The problem with this is that we live in a world that's inherently uncomfortable. So this is where the Buddha saw an opportunity for looking closely at human suffering. If we live in a world that's both pleasurable and painful, as the Chinese Buddha say, equally 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows, if there is both gain and loss and praise and blame and pleasure and pain and status and unpopularity in life, if those things are givens, and our brain only wants one. I want to feel accepted to be a part of the tribe. That's survival, right? I want you guys to like me. I want status. I want popularity. I want to feel pleasure. Our brain has come to equate pleasure with comfort and comfort with safety. If I feel good, my brain's very simple. It says, if you feel good, you feel safe. And so some of the ways I feel good actually make me feel safe. They are safe. Right, when I have connection with good friends, or when I have, you know, conversation, when I'm going through some stress and I connect with someone, that's, I feel good about that, and that's probably something that's constructive. A lot of ways that I feel good are destructive. You know, my brain rewards me for high calorie, high sugared foods because those were hard to find in hunting gathering tribes thousands of years ago. So I can go out and get as much of that as I want these days. It's not hard to find. Drugs and alcohol, sex and love addiction, we call these process addictions. All human beings from a Buddhist perspective are addicts because your brain likes pleasure and it avoids pain. And when we're unaware, when we lose active awareness, mindfulness, we will just unconsciously go with what they call the pleasure-pain strategy. Get pleasure, get rid of pain. Get pleasure, get rid of pain. And so it's not your fault. The Buddha is also not really even spiritual or religious in his teaching. He's not saying there's anything moral or immoral about pleasure. He actually gives a whole discourse on how much joy or sukha, contentment, that can come from the worldly pleasures. From good food and good company, and he even talks about being without debt, having a lot of money. You know, he talks about just the worldly pleasures that we experience. So we're not really being moral. We're just looking at how when we're unaware, these dynamics of getting pleasure and avoiding pain cause a lot of destructiveness in our lives. So the first thing I want to do is look at, as we practice, how do we work with or start to work with pain? when pain comes up. And so what I drew up here is, this is called the straight to the source, ride the wave strategy. So straight to the source, ride the wave. When you experience pain, let's start with physical pain. This person has a pain in their shoulder. There's going to be a primary feeling, right? The physical, let's say it's a throbbing feeling. You feel it in your shoulder. Now, when you feel pain, your mind is going to agonize over the pain. So there's mental agitation that comes on top of it. And when you're not mindful, when the pain reaches a peak, the agony, you become aware of the pain at that moment, and the agony hits you, agitates in the mind, and carries, and lasts longer than the primary pain itself. So when you have throbbing, a throbbing is an ebbing and flowing, right? It's a feeling of, if you've ever had, another way I like to give this example, if you ever had a stomach ache, right? Having a stomach ache, there's a point where you feel the stomach ache really packs a punch, right? And then it subsides a little bit. And then it really packs a punch, and then it subsides a little bit. And so when you feel pain, your attention's often drawn to it. The Buddha says, when touched with a feeling of pain, the person without mindfulness will sorrow, grieve, and lament, beat his breast, and become distraught. So in this way, this person will feel two pains, both physical and mental. Just as if they were to shoot this man with an arrow and right afterward were to shoot him with another one, so that he would feel the pains of two arrows. In the same way, when touched with a feeling of pain, the person without mindfulness will sorrow, grieve, and lament, beat his breast, become distraught, so he feels two pains, both physical and mental. And so with mindfulness, we can learn how to ride the wave of our primary feeling of pain. In this practice, what we're trying to do is we're trying to shift our awareness actually to the source of discomfort, in this case, at the shoulder, and to ride the ebb and flow of the pain, to try to focus intently on the primary feeling so you prevent your attention from getting wrapped up in mental agony or stories. So an example of this is very simple. You're sitting in meditation, you feel your shoulder hurts. Your mind says, ouch, that's painful. It doesn't even say that. It probably just has that attitude. You call that a mental state, attitude of mind, third foundation of mindfulness. So you feel the primary pain. You have a mental attitude, ouch, aversion is in your mind. Then you say, I shouldn't have gardened yesterday. My shoulder's not fully healed yet. Or you say, this isn't going to go away. I have felt this way for 2 years now, and I'm stuck with this bum shoulder. And so what's happening is your mind's creating a second pain. It's creating a story in this case. It's creating a story about you shouldn't have done something in the past, or it's going to always be this way in the future. And it seems very counterintuitive, and that's why I hesitate to sometimes teach this technical aspect. You got to kind of see for yourself. But if you can ignore the second mental story or agony that the mind is creating, and you can just be with the first pain, right? They say that pain is inevitable and suffering's optional. You get rid of the suffering about the pain, and you just are left with the pain itself. So it doesn't sound like the best. It's like a consolation prize. It's like, well, you don't get rid of pain, but you don't have to suffer about it. You don't have to agonize or create a story around it. And when mindfulness was brought into the Western world by Jon Kabat-Zinn, one of the first reasons why it was studied was to help people with chronic pain. And it seems like the most counterintuitive thing in the world. Why would I want to sit with my discomfort when I'm in discomfort? It's because when we can learn how to bring our attention to the primary feeling, go to the contraction in the body, soften it, feel the emotion of the energy that's in the body, feel the physical pain itself. We don't have to create this emotional distress. And they say that when your emotion brain gets overwhelmed, you don't think clearly, your executive function goes offline, you don't manage stress well. Right? So part of what we're talking about here is learning distress tolerance. And I talk about this a lot. I talked about this a couple weeks ago. Daniel Siegel is a scientist that studied our window of tolerance. And this is all about keeping us within our window of tolerance, of how do we stay with the primary feeling, even if it's uncomfortable, and stay out of the mental story, proliferation and agitation that surrounds it. And the beautiful thing about the window of tolerance is the more you practice it, the better you get, just like anything else. The more we sit with discomfort, the more easy it is to tolerate discomfort. But this isn't the only strategy. It's one of them. The other strategy, another strategy, is what I call the open-wide strategy, or the both-and strategy. And so when you feel discomfort, when I say pain, I don't mean just physical pain. I also mean mental pain. So let's say I'm sitting here during the meditation, I'm just chilling, everything's fine, and I have a thought about my work performance. I haven't been doing good at work lately. That thought just comes into my mind. What happens? The body will contract, right? The body will contract. If you relax the contraction, you'll probably feel a little bit of fear or anxiety in your sternum, or you'll feel a little bit of emotion under that contraction. So that, in that case, that's the primary emotion or the primary feeling, is that even a mental object, even a mental thought can produce a feeling of discomfort or pain. The open-wide strategy is where we practice opening our awareness to a wider field of your present experience, so the primary feeling is just a small part of a bigger container. And so this is what I call the difference between attention and awareness. In neuroscience, we have something they call the negativity bias, which means that our attention is drawn towards what we don't like. That's very unfortunate. That we tend to focus or hyper-focus on things that we don't like. Have you ever been in a room and someone's reading a book? You're reading a book and someone's talking in the other room? You know, and you can't stop hearing them talk in the background, right? That kind of hyper-focus. Your attention gets drawn towards discomfort. And so learning this open awareness practice, for those who've been coming a while, we call this background equanimity. Equanimity just means evenness of mind, being able to allow distress to be a part of your background experience. The reason why I call it both and is because, let's say I have a pain in my knee. My attention will go to the pain, and it will probably create a story about the pain. One strategy is to just go straight to the pain and get out of the story, ride the wave of it. Another strategy is to try to bring my awareness to the pain and then to include that sensation as a part of a bigger sensory experience. My left knee feels fine. Can I go to that? Can I bring my attention there? My hand feels fine. Can I bring my attention there? My stomach, when I relax it, feels all right. The temperature on my skin feels all right. So you can use your awareness to expand into a wider field. And this is something that I like to give this metaphor. It's like if you ever, like, let's say you go to the Grand Canyon. You know that how they have those like binoculars or whatever that you can pay a quarter for and you can zoom in on a part of your experience. It's like your attention when you're uncomfortable, or when, let's say even you have a mental fear. You're going on a date, right? And you think, oh shit, I'm going on a date, right? I want to go on a date, but I hate going on dates. That sucks. So having that emotion of fear and anxiety going into the mind and running around up here just creates all this extra stress. But being able to say, okay, anxiety, you're here. You're in the core of my body. I feel you racing and running and throbbing here. But I can also feel my feet and I feel my hands. And if I relax my body, I can feel the temperature on my skin. You can learn how to open your awareness. You can look around and notice that the sun's shining, right? So for every one thing that's true, something else is also true. For every one thing that your mind focuses on, there are other things that are here too. And that's why I call it the both-and strategy. And one of the ways that I have noticed this, background equanimity or being able to have something distressing happening and not consuming my attention, is just like I shared earlier, when I'm like reading a book or working, especially when I'm writing something and I'm like at a coffee shop or people are talking around me, I used to have such attention deficit issues, for lack of a better word, that I would not be able to get past a couple words before my mind would wander and get lost in the distraction. And the more and more I practice, I can let that be a part of the experience, but focus more clearly and connect more easily with my thoughts and what I'm experiencing. Whatever we practice, we get better at. We get better at attention. We get better at expanding our awareness. The third thing that we can practice is what I call skillful distraction. So this is very important. If the feeling that you're experiencing is overwhelming, then the best thing to do is sometimes to not sit with it, right? The best thing to do when we feel overwhelmed by a feeling is to find some way to take our attention off of it, to put our attention somewhere else. So in this example, you're not including it, and you're obviously not going to it. You're turning your attention to something else altogether. But something that I always say, you're not going to regret later, right? And so this practice is to shift your attention away from the source of discomfort, wait for the discomfort to calm down enough to a manageable level, and then you can switch back to one or two. Be with the experience, but in a different way. Some ways that we can distract: we can go for a walk, move the body. We know all of these things. So simple, it's easy to overlook, right? But mindfulness will point us to the simple answers. That's the thing that I love about this practice. Sometimes I'm amazed that I get paid to do this, because it's like, what am I saying? I'm telling people to go for a walk, right? Telling people to go look at like a sunset or color, you know. But these are the things that the mind wants to overcomplicate. When you're overwhelmed, focus all of your attention in something that's not overwhelming, right? Easy enough. But we've got to remember to recognize that we can do that. The more you practice mindfulness, the more you'll remember to recognize how you can skillfully distract when you're overwhelmed. In trauma therapy, they talk about titration, backing off and bearing down. So when you have your window of tolerance, if you get to an over-arousal state, you can't process in the therapy session. So if you're too overwhelmed, it's fruitless to sit there and continue talking about your emotion and what happened and blah, 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 blah. So when someone gets really overwhelmed and I'm with them, the main goal is to distract them. You know, we'll do something else, talk about something else, whatever, until they can calm down enough, right? And then even if there's distress, what you're trying to do is you're trying to still feel some distress, because that builds distress tolerance. But when it gets too distressing, you back off. And that's how you learn how to build your window of tolerance, is when you get overwhelmed, distract with something skillful, when it calms down, be with the feeling, feel the feeling, use one of these first two strategies. When you get overwhelmed, distract, so on and so forth. And again, the most important thing with distracting is that we don't use a distraction technique that's an avoidance technique or that we regret later. So there's a lot of ways when I feel distressed, especially as working in the mental health field, you know, we talk a lot, therapists talk endlessly about burnout and compassion fatigue and self-care. You know, but my mind with compassion, self-care, can look a lot like kind of laziness and, You know, sometimes it's like, oh, I'm going to sleep in today, self-care, you know, and really what I should be doing is probably getting up and like going to sit, right? Going to meditate. Or I'm going to watch like 5 episodes of The Office tonight, self-care, right? So when we distract, we got to be conscious and aware of it and distract in a way that isn't avoidance. Tricky, easier said than done. The last strategy, the last practice is where when you're experiencing something painful, primary feeling, you try to develop a relational attitude towards it. So one way to describe this in psychotherapy, they have something they call parts work, which is like where, let's say, you were triggered. Someone said something to you and you feel like, you feel abandonment comes up, or you feel worthless, shame comes up. And so that's a part of yourself. These parts of ourselves are probably going to be pretty familiar, right? You may not have a word for them, but you know when you feel that left out feeling, or when you feel that shame, I'm not worth it, I'm not worthy, I'm not good enough. Right, and so learning how to talk to these parts, and even if it's physical pain, right, even if it's not emotional, learning how to talk to your primary feeling. Oh, it's okay, knee. I know you hurt right now. It's okay. I can be with you. I call this the love everything strategy. It sounds like, it can sound like this kind of new agey vibe. But the Buddha was very clear that whatever we frequently think and ponder upon becomes the inclination of the mind. So if you are thinking that you're worthless and that you're hopeless and that you're alone and that you're forgotten, right? That the more you think about that, the more your mind's going to incline in that direction. And so we have to learn in this fourth strategy how to turn the mind. It's like turning a huge ship. When you practice these heart practices, is what we call them, if you've been coming for a while, metta, loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, equanimity. When you practice these qualities, the Buddha calls them the beautiful qualities of mind. When you practice them, you start to learn how to develop this emotional care and concern for both what's difficult and what's good.